Shrink Wrap Radio number 329, The Emotional Foundation of Mind, with Dr. Jaak Panksepp.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is psychologist, psychobiologist, neuroscientist, and author, Dr. Jaak Panksepp, and we'll be discussing his work on the development of new treatments for such disorders as ADHD through the study of the emotional circuits in the brains of animals. Dr. Jaak Panksepp is Bailey Endowed Professor of Animal Well-Being Science at the College of Veterinary Medicine, Washington State University, and founder of the field of affective neuroscience. Along with many students and colleagues, he has published over 400 scientific articles, chapters, and reviews devoted to elucidating the basic mechanisms of motivations and emotions, as well as the fundamental nature of consciousness and self-representation in the brain. Along with psychoanalyst Lucy Biven, he is the author of the 2012 book, Archaeology of Mind, Neuroevolutionary Origins of Human Emotion, as well as earlier books, including Affective Neuroscience, The Foundation of Human and Animal Emotions, and he's editor of a textbook of biological psychiatry, and seven other books. His current research is devoted to the analysis of emotional behaviors and their relations to models of psychiatric disorders. His main research interest is unraveling the nature of primary process emotions in the mammalian brain, seeking, fear, rage, lust, care, panic, and play, and seeking linkages to new clinical insights. His work has led to a variety of treatments and, among other things, is devoted to non-pharmacological therapies for ADHD and depression. Novel antidepressants and anti-suicide agents are currently being clinically evaluated. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Jaak Panksepp, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you very much, and I look forward to chatting with you.
Well, I'm very excited to chat with you, and I know that you're jet-lagged. You've told me that you have been traveling all over the place for the last several weeks in Europe.
Three and a half weeks.
So I just feel so lucky to be able to speak with you. I have to say I am in awe of your work and its potential impact for both psychology and psychotherapy. I've been spending time with your book, The Archaeology of Mind, Neuroevolutionary Origin of Human Emotions, and it's intellectually very exciting, and I believe it will become a classic. And as I was getting ready for our discussion here, I kind of took a look at the cover again, and the subtitle, Neuroevolutionary Origin of Human Emotions. Your book is so wide-ranging, and yet you've captured, in that subtitle, I think you've really captured its essence.
Well, I appreciate that, and I appreciate that you're finding it very useful. It was written to bring a naturalistic view of the brain and mind to the discussion, which often is lost in cognitive science, which takes a top-down approach, and very few people realize that we have to take the bottom-up approach to understand the whole.
Yeah, definitely. And we'll be getting into that more. But before we do, I've always assumed that your name was of Dutch origin. I'm not sure why, but it just, to me, it looked like it was a Dutch name. But a little background research revealed that you're originally from Estonia. How old were you when you first came to this country?
Well, my family escaped during World War II. I was 1 year of age. And we rambled around northern Germany. We landed in Poland, and you know, people had to catch whatever transportation they could. And you know, once the war was over, then you ended up in whatever victor's sector you happened to be in. And we were fortunate to be in the American sector. that allowed us passage to America in 1949 when I was 6 years old. And that was quite an adventure because all my education was here in America. But I still had Estonian roots and go back frequently.
Yeah. Oh, good. Good. And those, quotes, adventures, I'm sure must have laid down some circuitry in the emotional centers of your brain.
Yes, I am almost certain they did because we were in cities that received some carpet bombing Hamburg, and you know, there are a lot of human tragedies around one, even though one is too young to really appreciate the fullness of it. I'm sure I was traumatized a bit.
Right. Now, you're a psychologist, but rather than being in a psychology department, you're currently housed in the College of Veterinary Medicine at Washington State University. How did that come about?
Well, I have been a psychologist ever since my senior year in college, when I worked in the back wards of a psychiatric hospital and decided that the only way I could participate in the adventure of understanding human emotions was by perhaps going into clinical psychology, which I did, and at University of Massachusetts. And I had the good fortune to end up with a Veterans Administration traineeship, which put me in the Northampton State Hospital, where the training program eventually led me to spend most of my time in electroencephalography lab. So I had an early interest in the brain and emotions. Emotions came from dealing with psychiatric patients as a night orderly. And I thought I would learn a lot about emotions in clinical psychology, which I did not. It was the heyday of behavioral modification.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Well, I think you and I are roughly the same age, same generation. Actually, mm-hmm. I did 3 years of internship at a VA hospital. And in, I think it was Allen Park, Michigan was the, and also the one in Ann Arbor, I think. Mm-hmm. And, I didn't know about your clinical background and your clinical training, and it makes a lot of sense. And what a wonderful example you're setting for my listeners who are wanting to go into, who are wanting to be therapists. But so much of what therapy, being a therapist, is going to demand in the future, I think, is rooted in the kind of work that you and other neuroscientists have been doing. We're going to have to be smarter about that kind of thing, I think.
I certainly agree. I think we have become much more interdisciplinary, as psychology has to be. When I got into psychology, I was rather appalled that the brain wasn't right up there front and center of discussions.
Yeah.
Since mind is a function of the brain.
Right.
We should know about the organ.
Yeah, well, I had to take a course in what was called physiological psychology at the time. And mostly we learned the names of these different structures in the brain, but I don't think much was known about what they did. So it wasn't very functional.
Well, there was a lot of talk about feeding and drinking, and, you know, people in Neil Miller's lab at Yale had discovered neurochemistries that activated the feeding urges, and others like carbachol, a cholinergic stimulant, would induce animals to drink. So there was the beginning of a neuroscience of behavioral processes, and there was also a neuroscience of mind as soon as Olds and Milner discovered that the brain had a reward system.
Yes.
What are rewards without feelings?
Yes, well, that really gets to the heart of what you've been working on and writing about. Well, you've done so much groundbreaking work that it's hard to know where to jump in. However, jump in we will. Much of your research is focused on affective systems in the brain, and I want to make sure that all my listeners understand that the word affect or affective refers to emotions. And in the recent evolution of psychology, first there was a lot of focus on sensation and perception, you know, going back to Wundt and those guys, then on behavior, then on cognition, and now you've turned the spotlight on emotion. Why? What's the importance of emotion in the big picture?
Yeah, well, I think all of us have these emotional powers that have remained mysteries. We attach words to them, and, we can't agree on what the words mean. Even we can't agree what emotion is for real. I tend to follow a Darwinian approach that the emotions of animals have certain displays, like when an animal gets angry, it's very clear. When they're scared, it's behaviorally very clear. So I think that tradition was not cultivated too much in psychology except in facial expressions.
Mm-hmm.
But, the facial expressions are fairly clear signals that something is happening inside the mind. But there's been battles between the different schools of psychology, and, one of the most powerful schools has been constructivism, that we actually construct meaning through our use of words and the complexities of the world. And the other approach is more basic, that we do have fundamental processes, sensation, perception, maybe some low-level cognitions and emotions. And my own attitude was that if you want to understand emotional feelings, these things are called affects, the affective component of emotion, then we literally have to go into the brain. Otherwise, we're just talking about it on the surface and often disagreeing with each other, as has been very common in the study of emotions in psychology. Many theories, many people talking past each other, but no one having any idea what an emotional feeling really is.
You mentioned the study of faces as part of the early study of emotions, and animals have faces too, and much of your research is focused on animals. I remember in my own graduate school training many years ago that they kept pounding into our heads that any ideas we had about emotions in our cats or dogs, we were simply anthropomorphizing, that we were simply projecting and could have no way of knowing what the animal might or might not be feeling. And I think people who have pets have always found that a bit hard to swallow. And in fact, you've written that behavioral scientists need to get real about the emotional feelings of other animals. So this is clearly something that you feel very passionate about.
Well, I think that is the aspect of emotion that links up to human psychiatric problems most. Most psychiatric problems have an emotional feeling component. And if we don't understand the feeling component, then we will not make progress on psychotherapies as well as somatic and pharmacological therapies. We might by chance, but it won't be scientific knowledge. So my attitude was that when I entered graduate school, there was already enough data to point us where in the brain we had to go, which were very low regions, very subcortical regions. And, this was based upon Olds and Milner's discovery of rewarding effects by stimulating very deep brain regions. And all that was preceded by Walter Hess's work in Switzerland, where he was trying to map the autonomic nervous system back in the 20s and 30s. And he was using deep brain stimulation to do this, to find which areas you stimulate and get cardiac changes and blood pressure and respiratory changes and other autonomic effects. And he just stumbled on the fact that often the cats would become enraged, show an anger display that was very clear on their body surface.
Oh, yes.
But he didn't want to deal with a feeling component because he confessed in his last writings after he took retirement that he did not want his work to be marginalized by the powerful American behaviorists. But he always felt the animals had a feeling, but he chose to call it sham rage.
Hmm. Fascinating.
Which was a tragedy.
Yeah.
But understandable. Now, I map the rage system in rats for the first time in my PhD dissertation. That was 1969. And I went the additional step and asked the animal, do you like the stimulation or do you dislike it? Namely, is it a reward that you turn on or is it a punishment that you want to turn off? And the answer was very clear. Every place you activated an anger display, the animal wanted to turn it off. But there were other areas that also produced aggression, but this was predatory aggression. And guess what? The animals like to turn that on.
Uh-huh. No wonder we have so much crime.
I think a lot of psychopathic behavior is really predatory.
Mm-hmm. You know, yeah. Well, building on what you've just been saying, you've been studying the emotional side of the brain, and you have identified seven, what you call, core mammalian emotions, which are seeking, rage, fear, lust, care, panic/grief, and play. So, I don't know if this is too big a task or not.
I capitalized them.
Yes, and you capitalized them throughout the book.
That's awfully important.
Well, I can see why, because you really make a case that that sort of all of psychic structure is more or less built on these core emotions.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe you can tell us about a little bit about each one and why they're important.
Well, let me just highlight that I put them in that sequence for a very specific reason. I put seeking first because that is the biggest and most universal of the emotional systems, and that is really a good name for what Olds and Milner called the brain reward system. Mm-hmm. The system is clearly rewarding, but it's nothing like pleasure. At least our typical understanding of pleasure is a sensory feeling, like, you know, sugar on the tongue or bitterness being, a negative feeling. So, we have lots of sensory feelings, but sensory feelings that lead to pleasure and displeasure are not emotions. They're affects. So affect is a generic term for valence feelings. So, in my view, we have three types of valence feelings: the sensations that come into us from the external world, the sensations that our body collects, namely homeostatic affects. So there's sensory affects from the outside world. There's homeostatic affects like hunger and thirst from the inside of the body. We have specialized receptors in the brain for that. And then we have within brain affects, the most subtle ones of all, which I call the emotional affects. And the most primitive one is this seeking system because it serves the general function of finding resources. An animal to survive has to chase resources with enthusiasm. So the actual feeling produced by the system is one of, in its highest form, maybe euphoria. In milder forms, enthusiasm. The animals engage with the world. And this is the general purpose system for finding all the resources for survival. Now, often you have to compete for resources with other animals, and one good way to compete is to get angry. So we have a rage system that allows us to protect our resources. Now, other animals often want us as a resource, so we have to protect ourselves.
Yeah.
And we do have a fear system that produces a very characteristic fear response. And, of course, to be a mammal is to reproduce, and you don't leave reproduction a chance. So there have to be lust systems, rather different in males and females, but also with many shared components. And the function of lust is to bring forth babies and continue into the future generations. So you have to be prepared. The brain has to be prepared to take care of the babies. So there's a care system. And many people have studied the sexuality and maternal behavior in animals. I've not spent too much time on that. But once you have babies, the babies also have to communicate to the mother how desperately they need them, especially if they're lost. So we started mapping a separation distress system by monitoring the crying of little young ones separated from mom for short periods of time. And we identified the neural circuits for this, and we call them the panic circuit, or sometimes slash grief circuit, because people don't understand why we called it the panic system. We called it a panic system because we suspect that psychiatrically it is the fundamental source of panic attacks, which people know is not the source of generalized anxiety disorders. That's more the fear system. And finally, we were rather surprised that, you know, when we contemplated what other systems might exist at the primary process level, people said, well, disgust. And I said, well, that's a homeostatic feeling. That's your body's attempt to remove toxic substances from the body. And we use it symbolically, as in social disgust. Other people said, dominance surely must be a fundamental process. I said, well, we haven't seen it with brain stimulation, and surely dominance needs to be learned. If you build that into the system, then animals really can't compete and come out on top. That's just a genetic issue. But we started saying maybe play is a fundamental process of the brain, and there was no neuroscience of play, and we decided simply to make animals hungry for play, young animals, put them alone, and then put them together. And lo and behold, they showed a wonderful play sequence, you know, very dynamic, very rich, and very positive. Animals would run for it very readily. And we had trouble mapping it in the brain because you have two animals interacting. But one of the first studies we did was take the whole neocortex away to see if play required the neocortex, and the answer was a resounding no. A totally decorticate animal plays normally. And
now that's fascinating.
Yeah, so
yeah.
Play is, I think, the most wonderful of the emotions because it takes us into the social terrain to learn about the social world.
Mm.
And I think that's the basic function. All mammals cannot have all the social rules built in by genetics, but they should have a system that allows them to joyously learn about the social world when they're young, and play seems to fulfill that.
So this is great, the way that you've laid it out and sequenced it for us. And so this is sort of a evolutionary given across mammals, and even you've suggested maybe even birds and other species, kind of a fundamental set of, you know, we use computer metaphors so much, a fundamental set of routines that we all come into the world with.
Yeah, I like a more kind of a human description. They're tools for living.
Okay.
You know, they're built in, they're instinctual, doesn't mean they're not refined by experience or modified by experience. Of course they are, but they seem to actually ground the organism in certain fundamental capacities that are absolutely essential for survival. And if evolution had not built those in, and you have to learn everything, then it would truly be rather incredible that organisms would survive. So that is the foundation of behavior. I think it's also the foundation of mind. And I think that's where psychology begins, and that is where the least amount of research has been done.
Mm-hmm. Now, sticking with play a bit, one of the things that you're known for is tickling rats and recording their laughter, which I think I recall as ultrasonic. Does that mean it's beyond our range of hearing? Yeah. Tell us a bit about that and how you discovered that.
Well, it was chance. And we had been studying play as a fundamental process for about 20 years. And one of the big projects was to see what sensory systems were most important for play. And for rats, it turned out to be touch. And we used touch to follow the pathway up into the thalamus and see that the projections into the cortex were less important for play than the lower projections into the reticular systems. And we also looked at hearing, and we did not cut any nerves. We just put wax plugs in the animal's ear, and play was reduced about 25%. Not as much as anesthetizing various parts of the body, but still substantial. And the vision wasn't important for rats at all, surprisingly.
So that gave you the clue that there was something social involved and that it had something to do with hearing and not vision.
Yes. So touch was the most important one, but remember, hearing is a specialized form of touch. So our cochlea has these hair cells that are measuring the vibration in the air, and that's transduced in a kind of somatic vibration of the eardrum. And that is really a specialized form of touch. And I had postdoc Brian Knutson, who, you know, came in without any experience in neuroscience research. He was social personality in a NIH training program that was coming out of Berkeley. And, you know, I explained all the things we're studying, and he asked me, is there a play vocalization? And I said, well, not that we've heard, because when you listen in, there's no sounds the animals are making. And he was a little disappointed on that. And I said, but don't be disappointed that, you know, these animals communicate in the ultrasonic range that we can't hear, and we don't have the technology for it. So if you want to study that, we will buy the ultrasonic equipment and see whether animals make play sounds. When the equipment came in the very first day, Brian found there was this chirping. Mm-hmm. And he studied the chirping for a solid year and made a lot of progress. And he thought it was a general measure for appetitive desire. And he was partly correct, but I still thought it was still something very special for play. And when he went to NIH to do some of the first brain imaging in neuroeconomics, I had an undergraduate working with me that I was training on how to do some of the experiments, Jeff Bergdorf, and you know, we were doing play studies and listening to the ultrasonics, and then I got my hands dirty with it a lot more than I had when Brian had been working on it. And I just woke up one morning and said, what if that is laughter? I came in and Jeff was waiting for me. I simply said, Jeff, let's go tickle some rats. And Jeff looked at me and said, okay. And we went. He was listening to the ultrasonics and I was tickling the rat, which was really hand play. So the animal, instead of playing with another rat, I was playing with it as if my hand was another rat, but a very dominant one. And they all chirped, first one, second one, third one, fourth one. We have not found a young animal that doesn't chirp at all.
Did they seem at all drawn to it? You know, was there evidence that they liked it in the sense of...
Yes.
Uh-huh.
One early experiment was that Jeff would pet a rat, and I would tickle the same rat, in a systematic way, that so they had the same amount of touch. And then we just put our hands in opposite corners of a large box and see where the animal went. The animal overwhelmingly went to the tickle hand.
what a clever and simple yet clever design. I love that.
And then Jeff did a project where he trained rats to press a lever to have his hand come down and tickle them. And they worked for that.
Wow.
So we've done it every possible way that you can, you know, place preference, et cetera. We've even mapped the circuitry. And this was Jeff's PhD dissertation. And every place that you evoke the chirp in the brain is rewarding. The animal wants to turn the juice on to produce that feeling.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out that all of the chirping runs along the seeking system. So Brian, the postdoc who first discovered the play vocalization, he was correct, too, that this is a general measure of desire. So we have been using that measure, maybe we'll come to it later, as a way to develop new antidepressants.
Yes, we will come to that. That's definitely something I want us to talk about. Now, continuing in this vein of affect in animals, just yesterday I read in the paper about a researcher in the UK who's found that chimpanzees go through a midlife crisis.
Yes.
did you see that research?
I did see that.
Yeah.
I think it basically means that they get a whole lot more laid back sexually than they were. They don't seem to show as much enthusiasm for sex. Is that what you read?
I don't recall it being specifically about sexuality, but they said that in human beings, in terms of measurements of level of happiness, life satisfaction, etc., that there's a U-shaped curve, that we start out high somewhere in early adulthood, and then it dips down and reaches its nadir in middle age, and then begins to rise again as we approach age 70, I think, is where it peaks. And so they said that they were finding a similar U-shaped curve in the chimpanzees.
Yeah. Now, I wonder what would be a psychological measure there. I'd like to read the original papers. I thought in one of the reports it was implying that their enthusiasm for sex was diminishing as a possible measure. And, of course, that's understandable because your hormones are going way down and, you know, your bodily vigor is diminished as you age. So.
Yeah, that certainly makes sense, and I didn't track down the papers. I just, you know, read it in the newspaper where it was given about, you know, 4 column inches. Mm-hmm. So one could definitely chase down more about it.
I definitely think that we both should and see what the facts are.
Yeah.
The press often runs with a conclusion, and often the facts do not necessarily support the conclusion very well.
Oh, yes, yes. Now, so you've pointed out that these primary emotional circuits, and by the way, a number of places in the book you refer to primary process, and that puts me in mind of Freud, who made a distinction that I've always found very meaningful between primary process thinking and secondary process thinking. How are you using primary process? Are you referring to something related to that, or is it different?
I think I am using it rather differently. I think it was certainly inspired by Freud's usage, but I think there has to be a general concept for things that are built into the brain that have psychological meaning. And for me, that is primary process. And as far as I can tell, that, you know, there are two types of things that are built in low. One is a series of feeling systems, affect systems, sensory affects, homeostatic affects, and emotional affects. Only the last one's really important for psychiatry. And there is no thinking down below, but there are rewards and punishments down below. And, you know, we can tell that there's a psychological aspect to these systems only by asking if we artificially activate them, are they rewards and punishments? That's our access to the animal mind. On top of that, we've got learning and memory. And learning and memory gives us simple ideas about the world, but usually it's guided by our affects. So I think the actual lower level that is precognitive is the part that actually controls, those neural circuits control the learning process, but the learning process is deeply unconscious. So Freud, I think, made the fundamental mistake of making the id unconscious, whereas these drives, homeostatic ones, these powerful internal brain feelings, emotional feelings, sensory feelings, they are built in as guides for living. And so the fundamental primary process I'm talking about has affective consciousness already, as monitored by rewarding and punishing effects of circuits. The next level is the unconscious. You know, there's no reason learning and memory have to be conscious. They're just brain mechanisms to parse the feelings into space and time, into the real world that you're living in. You have to identify those sensory rewards that support your body. You have to be able to identify the objects in the world that your seeking system should be devoted to, or the things that you have to avoid, things like that create fear and panic. So, you know, I think the original concept of the law of effect, that the behavior is generated as a general purpose model for learning, should have been the law of affect. And I think Thorndike's original words were affective words, namely if something increases your positive feelings of comfort, you will do more of them. If anything produces discomfort, you will do less of it. So Thorndike actually had affective words, but the affect was thrown out as basically just verbal trash as opposed to biological reality. And I think they made it such a dramatic mistake that led the field of psychology without proper guidance for over a century. And, you know, some emotion researchers tried to get it back on track, but they were not doing neuroscience. And I think it's the neuroscience that is really the most solid nail in the argument, that those systems actually mediate these rewards and punishments that behavior is used to control behavior. Remember, they only had two made-up words for the whole level, which were unconditioned stimuli and unconditioned responses. In fact, all of those things are experienced affectively, and they control learning. So on top of that, there's a level of, you know, cognitive processes that are incredibly important, but we cannot study those very well in animals. And when we have such a massively enlarged cortical space for doing these, obviously we can have thoughts that other animals can't imagine. We are the most cognitive creature in the world. It doesn't mean the other creatures aren't cognitive also, but that is a mental landscape that one cannot do as rigorous neuroscience on as the basic emotional feelings and other affects.
So
that's a long answer.
Yeah, well, that's a good answer, and it anticipates about two questions I was going to ask you, you know, about the relationship between the the old brain and the neocortex, mm-hmm. and you've really gone through that well. And
yeah, let me just make one remark. It's pretty clear that the top of the brain could do nothing at all without the bottom of the brain. The bottom of the brain can do a heck of a lot without the top of the brain. And a lot of people don't realize this, and they think the bottom of the brain is unconscious, deeply unconscious and implicit. Well, it is not at the affective level. That's where the affects actually emerge from. So there is a certain primitive form of consciousness, and that primitive form probably is absolutely essential for higher forms. And that idea is not yet common currency. It's not even being talked about in psychology and even consciousness studies.
So it seems it seems like the behaviors were on the right track in a way. I mean, they had zeroed in on reward systems, but they were leaving out, if I understand you correctly, they were leaving out the experiential component for both animals and humans.
They threw it away completely as nonsense. And if you look at their ontology, you know, the kind of knowledge they really wanted, they did not seek understanding. They sought behavioral control. They thought that was sufficient. Now, of course, wonderful experiments were done, wonderful, rigorous methodologies were done, but the organism was left out of the equation. And the ethologists spent a lot of time studying the natural behavior of the organism, but I think everyone should have recognized and explicitly said that to understand the organism, we have to understand the brain. The rest is description, surface description. Ethologists were not satisfied with a surface description, and neuroethology emerged, you know, fairly early in the neuroscience game. The behaviors were in denial that one even had to understand the brain to understand behavior.
Yeah, they said it was a black box and all you needed to study was input and output and it didn't matter what was going on in the black box.
It's a tragic view, but, you know, these people are still guiding a lot of the powerful places within academic psychology.
Yes.
And they still carry their biases. They're more implicit now. Many of them are neuroscientists, but now they're saying only neural systems count. The psychology still does not count without the recognition that some of these neural systems generate psychological states. And that's a tragedy still.
Well, that leads into my next question, which has to do with the implications of your work on the emotional circuitry of the brain for psychotherapy.
Well, that's a very, very large question, but that's easiest to address with the most emotional disorders, such as anxiety disorders. When a person comes in with generalized anxiety disorder or specific phobias, the thing that's bothering them is an internal psychological state that feels terrible. And if that terrible feeling can be taken away, often they would not have the desire to see someone, a psychotherapist, that can help them talk through things. Schizophrenia is more chaotic. You know, it's much more of a cognitive disorder, but the person gets isolated, and this isolation leads them to lead very unsatisfactory emotional lives. We have panic attacks, and, you know, the only reason the person comes in is because all of a sudden the psychological bottom, psychological floor seems to drop out of them, and they're just in total insecurity. And that's one reason we think that insecurity is very similar to the insecurity a young animal feels when they're separated from mother or caretakers. We've got obsessive compulsive disorders. Often they are to regulate unusual feelings, that if you do certain behavior patterns, the intensity of the feelings is diminished. And then the common cold of psychiatry is depression. The reason people come in is because they are so lacking in the desire to live. They don't have enthusiasm for life. They're not getting the pleasure out of life that they used to. And many decide to take their life. It's not worth living. So that's the psychopathology that we've been working on more than any other, because it's the biggest one, and it connects up with our emotional systems very nicely. We know that depression, the most biggest cause of depression, is losing loved ones, losing social support. So we study the separation distress or panic system, panic slash grief, and we think that that is one of the major entry points into this anhedonia, the lack of desire to live, that characterizes very severe depression. And so we have a very simple theory about the main emotional source of it. We know a lot about the chemistries, all derived from animal research. The human investigations are consistent with our findings. So, you know, when we said that the feeling of loneliness and grief is mediated by the neural circuitry of separation distress, people that have done PET imaging of human sadness find the same areas of the brain light up. And we think that too much activity in this system leads to a depletion of the seeking urge, which is the number one system for enthusiasm to live and do things. And we think that the chemistries that can diminish panic, as well as those that can elevate seeking, might be good targets for antidepressants. So this is the general way we've approached one psychiatric disorder.
Okay. Now, as we think about disorders, there are sort of basically two ways to go. One would be the sort of biochemical medicine approach, and the other would be talk therapy. And we know that talk therapy can impact the brain and change circuitry within the brain. I think there's some evidence for that. And on the biological side, you've written that Big Pharma has slowed down their development of psychiatric drugs, and that those that they have, that they've been using, were developed as the result of fortuitous accidents rather than any kind of systematic planning. And you advocate for a different approach. Can you take us through that?
Yeah, I think it's pretty well recognized in the biological psychiatry community that something has gone wrong in translating our basic knowledge about the brain into new mind medicines that might be useful for people with psychiatric disorders. And, you know, why has there been such a big failure? First of all, American companies almost uniformly have dropped their psychiatric drug development programs where you study animals as the foundational level of understanding. Europe is going the same direction, but not so severely yet. So we do know that everything that we have that psychiatrists prescribe was literally discovered by chance, not by any systematic human knowledge. The molecules were refined and made cleaner and more specific once people discovered some of their main effects in the brain. So science has been very good at polishing up the molecules, but not generating new concepts. And my personal bias is that this is because the behaviorist revolution, where, you know, people develop wonderful models of learning and memory, and, you know, some of them were fear learning and, you know, had what commonly would be called emotional components, but they were never designed for psychiatric disorders. They were not even addressed to tackle what I think is the most important question, which is what is the nature of an emotional feeling? Because people come in with imbalanced emotional feelings, unregulated, not coordinating with their cognitive activities. So we have been now advocating a different perspective that on the basis of science, we can claim that animals do have emotional feelings. Now, the power is against us at this moment in time. For instance, Joe Ledoux wrote a paper this year in the journal Neuron, and he basically used me as the way you shouldn't go.
Ah.
And he said, we will never understand what animals feel. It's a categorical statement. The book is closed, and Panksepp trying to open it with anthropomorphism is silly. He took two pages to have an ad hominem attack on me without covering my data. And the attack was, again, the attack against anthropomorphism. And I wrote him a note promptly and said, Joe, I don't understand the ad hominem attack on me. And he wrote back and said, it's not an ad hominem attack. And I said, of course it is. You haven't talked about my research. You've talked about me as being an anthropomorphist, which I am not. I said, what I have been doing all my career is zoomorphism. I have been trying to bring our animal past into our present understanding of psychological processes. So I've been trying to bring our animal emotions back to the human species. he chose not to respond to that. But, it really is a tragedy. We share so many processes with other animals. Modern medicine has been based on studying animal bodies. The study of animal bodies has told us more about our own biochemistry than the study of human bodies. This doesn't mean they're exactly the same, but there are general principles to be discovered, and I believe this is the same for emotional feelings. Like, one reason I capitalized my emotional terms, seeking, rage, fear, lust, care, panic, grief, and play, is because I'm talking about an emotional circuit in the brain that can generate emotional behaviors using deep brain stimulation. And that is rather miraculous. You're putting electrical garbage into the brain and coherence comes out. That means that the animal's brain has the coherence built in. And one might say, you're only generating behavior, but we always evaluate whether the states are rewarding or punishing. Mm-hmm. And that is our access to the feeling. We would never say they're identical. You know, everyone that does evolutionary approaches realizes evolution is diversity. There are always differences among species. And we cannot study those differences very well, but I think the general principle is the same, and the general principle is that emotional circuits, these ancient powers of the brain, actually have feelings as indicated by different rewards and punishments. So that's the story, and I think psychiatry can use it more effectively to develop new medicines.
Well, one focus of your work has been on developing new approaches for treating autism and also ADHD. And for one thing, you've speculated that play, one of the seven core emotions, may be important for the treatment of ADHD. Tell us a little about that.
Well, it came to us through studying play and not just a pure idea off the top of our heads. When we started analyzing the pharmacology that might modulate play, it turned out that all of the psychostimulants that we use to treat ADHD, Ritalin, amphetamine in earlier days, they all reduce play. Even though they're psychostimulants, they do not activate the play urge. So that immediately suggests that we are taking play away from our kids by giving these medicines. And many parents complain that when they get on these medicines, fine, they're sitting still in school, but it looks like the child has been taken out of them. So, you know, they kind of just look out blankly through windows, and they're not the engaging, wonderful creatures that our children are in our lives. So then we started doing experimental studies. You know, not only do they reduce play, but they sensitize the brain. And when you give these drugs to animals repeatedly, certain systems in the brain, especially the seeking system, seems to get more powerful. So I think psychologically one might say that instead of just wanting stuff, you become very urgent to want stuff. So instead of saying, I want it, you say, I want it now, which is not a well-regulated response. I've encouraged clinicians to evaluate this in humans for more than a dozen years. No one has yet tested that idea. It's very testable since so many kids are getting into the medication pipeline and others have had it for a long time, and we just have to evaluate whether the same dose has slightly different autonomic effects. So it's easy to do, but it hasn't been done. But we did the following study. We know that when you do structural imaging of the brain, the ADHD brain is not dramatically abnormal in any way, but it's a little shorter in the frontal lobes, especially in the right frontal lobes. It's about 5% smaller. That's statistically significant. So we took a bunch of regular rats and we took away the right frontal lobe or left frontal lobe. And it turns out these animals are wild. They play like crazy. You know, they're out of control with their play urges. And, you know, if a child comes into class and is too playful, it's a problem for the teacher, right? So we simply asked if we take these frontal lobe animals, deficit animals, and we allow half of them plenty of play and the other half no play, are they better regulated as young adults? And the answer was clear. If you have lots of play, you are a more regulated young adult, less impulsive, which means that play helps the upper brain to mature. And then we did a lot of genetic work and, looking at neuronal activation in the cortex. The whole cortex lights up during play. It turns on piles of genes. So are we, by giving anti-play drugs and in a sense marginalizing play as a necessary part of childhood, are we taking something valuable away from our kids? I think we are, and I have tried to open up a new conversation on those issues.
Yeah, that's a very interesting way into that conversation, and something that I've noted and mentioned on the series before, is that kids' lives are so much more regimented than they were when I grew up. We had sort of vacant lots nearby, and we would go in and we would play and throw dirt clods at each other and play football and baseball and so on. And now, most kids, for example, my grandkids, they really can't go out of the house on their own. The yard isn't big enough for them to go play in. The world's too dangerous to let them just roam like I roamed Los Angeles when I was growing up on a bicycle all over the place. Now kids are, you know, taken to ballet, taken to karate by their parents, etc. And it's a very regimented life, and maybe not one so full of play.
Yeah, I think it needs a much wider conversation. And, you know, I've been trying to advocate for a long time that for the real young kids, we have to literally design playgrounds, play sanctuaries where they can really do it their way. You know, they probably will not have the flexibility that you and I had to roam as we wished and, you know, join up with your buddies for games of your own making.
Yes.
But by golly, kids love this stuff, and we have to have large spaces preserved for them, and where they can play as they want. you know, maybe have a couple of, you know, youngsters, teenagers, sports people hanging around, making sure that, you know, when things happen, that, you know, you can go in there and readjust the dynamics a little bit. I mean, we had a play sanctuary project at Bowling Green when I was still there at Bowling Green State University. And we, after a year of negotiating, the school system allowed us to take a gymnasium in an old school administration building and retrofit it with wrestling mats and, you know, some sound systems. And preschoolers, kids before they get to kindergarten that have preschool classes, they could come, parents could bring them in half an hour early, and they would have a play sanctuary to play as they pleased. And, of course, we learned they loved it. And bad things happened, too, and they were perfect moments to go in and kind of resolve the conflicts and give the reward of going back to play, which was the most important thing for them.
Yeah. Now, early on in my reading of your book, I found myself thinking that your work must have implications for PTSD. So I immediately went to the index in the back of the book, and I couldn't find anything under PTSD. But then, you can give the publisher a hard time for that. But then I did find a whole section when I looked under the word trauma, and I felt fairly traumatized myself just by reading it in a very personal way. You share, first of all, a traumatic event of being scalded in early childhood, but then an even more harrowing account of cancers that both you and your wife endured, along with side effects and doctor-caused complications of various sorts. So first of all, I have to congratulate you on your courage and your will to live. I won't ask you to recount here that litany of traumatic experiences in your life. I was fascinated. I don't want to re-traumatize you or the rest of us. I was fascinated to read about your experience of the EMDR therapy for trauma developed by Francine Shapiro, who it was my pleasure and privilege to interview several years ago as well. I've also been covering the work on memory reconsolidation and was glad to read your discussion of that in the same section. So maybe you can say a little bit about your experience with EMDR and give us some of your top of mind thoughts about how it might work.
Sure. Yeah, I think PTSD is something that can be very easily modeled in animals. Bob Adamek at Memorial University in Canada has done wonderful work on it. You know, you can even traumatize animals simply by stimulating the amygdala, for instance. Then the animals become hyper fearful. So there's plenty of animal models for it. But the human situation, you know, really, that's been one of the most difficult disorders to deal with. Now, Francine Shapiro's discovery many years ago that, you know, these exploratory eye movements seem to be able to dampen the negative traumatic state that becomes chronic. No one knows how it works, and I certainly don't either, but when I was in the middle of this stem cell transplant, and, you know, I had the iatrogenic one thing after another, Sandra Paulson and a couple of other clinicians in Seattle said, well, why don't you come by and, you know, we hear that you have ideas on PTSD and maybe you have some ideas on how EMDR might work. And when Sandra essentially gave me the kind of sessions that she usually does, where she, you know, very skillfully brings up emotional material to the point where you are feeling it. So she basically had me feel fear and loneliness and, you know, usually negative feelings. And she used a light bar, which they sell now. Some people still tap the knees or, you know, move their fingers. But she used a light bar. And once I said I was feeling the emotion, she turned the light bar on back and forth My eyes would follow the lights. And lo and behold, as soon as I started moving my eyes, the emotion just melted away. The feeling melted away. Mm-hmm. And we said, oh, let's do it again. And we did it with every emotion, and the same thing happened to me. So this is me search, not research. But I have been advocating, some clinicians, if they want a really fine and simple experiment, they should document that little bit of me search. And the way I kind of see it happening is, we know from neuroanatomy that the most important area for emotions is not the amygdala, as some people have marketed, but it is in the midbrain, at the very core of the brain, area called periaqueductal gray, because that's where we get emotional behaviors at the lowest amount of electricity for deep brain stimulation. The same follows for the rewarding and punishing effects. And right above it, you have superior colliculus that harvests visual information. So the superior colliculus, part of the four twins, corpora, quadra, gemina, the top two superior ones are for vision, the two bottom ones, inferior ones, are for audition, which means audition is more ancient than vision in brain evolution, by the way. You can read these passages of evolution if you really understand the brain. But the superior colliculus, the top layer on the surface, is for vision. The next layer gets auditory information. The next layer below gets touch information. And now you're almost to the PAG, where the emotions are organized. But between those sensory layers and the PAG, you've got a cell layer that controls exploratory eye movements. And those cells can control things above as well as things below. So one can imagine that eye movements are able to inhibit the PAG, which is the most powerful source of emotionality in the brain. So that's the neuroscience point of view, and the more kind of theoretical psychological point of view is that, you know, every human being knows that when they're in an emotional state, their upper brain, as Freud said, the secondary process, our complex thoughts don't work very well. And at the same time, when we're really engaged in reading a novel, our higher part of the brain is really engaged, we cannot feel emotions as intensely as we would otherwise. And there's a pile of brain imaging indicating that the higher cognitive brain and the lower emotional brain are in seesaw balance. That one, when one is very active, the other is inhibited. So I see EMDR, the exploratory eye movements, as shifting you from an internal state, which PTSD is, into an external world-oriented state, and that means that you're inhibiting the primitive emotions. So that's a testable theory, and I don't know whether it's right or wrong until someone tests it.
Yeah, okay. Well, we're getting towards the end here, but I wanted to ask you about your relationship to, or the relationship of your work to that of depth psychotherapy, because, for example, I know you've done some work with Mark Solms, who I had the privilege mm-hmm. of interviewing about neuropsychoanalysis, and mm-hmm. I see you've gotten some awards kind of in that area, that your mm-hmm. co-author of this book is a psychoanalyst. Yeah. So say a little bit about your relationship to neuropsychoanalysis.
Well, I think the relationship started by people at the New York Psychoanalytic Society becoming enthusiastic about affective neuroscience when it first came out. I would say psychoanalysts were the first group of clinicians and scholars that really found this very useful. is a description of a data-based, neuroscience-based vision of our primary emotional lives. Now, they're working with the secondary process, as they say usually, as opposed to the primary process, but they know that the primary process is controlling a lot of your thinking. So they invited me to do lectures there and eventually asked me to do an extended series of workshops, which lasted for about 6 years. So I was delighted since, you know, I'd originally wanted to be a clinician and my work has been inspired by clinical issues. So I find that psychoanalysis is now in a transitional phase. They have always been the people that have stood up for understanding the mental depth of human beings. And they seem to be quite receptive that the mental depth of human beings is linked integrally to the primitive emotions that all mammals share. So it's been really a delightful relationship. And I think they even appreciate the kind of medicinal development that we are pursuing, because we're pursuing our animal models, namely preclinical models, with an eye to actually modeling the feeling state, which can be done. For instance, our happy calls that occur during play that we can control with tickling, we actually have a psychoassay for positive social feelings. And, you know, one of the ideas we've shared therapeutically that links up with a reconsolidation hypothesis that is very hot. You know, many, many people are seeing reconsolidation as one of the keys to psychotherapy. Now, of course, reconsolidation is that a memory is not forever and ever like a Mount Everest. It is a dynamic thing, and every time you bring memories back, as in psychoanalysis, you probably do better than any other psychotherapy. Of course, you can have rapid emotional dynamic therapies that are fast forms where you bring the emotional material up, and by bringing it up, when it goes back into the memory store, it carries the most recent feelings along with it. And our argument has been, well, at those moments of transition, it's wise for the therapist to find a positive affect. You know, we've done it in rats by tickling them, but we're not suggesting that, you know, clinicians tickle their patients right. or tell, you know, lewd jokes or anything like that. But I think you can find moments of human relatedness where you share a perspective, where you see life in a humorous way. So, you know, we suspect that if a clinician is able to bring those moments to the forefront with a very reflective, deep human eye where both people have an insight, and that's what jokes are all about, you have an insight and you have shared laughter, then that awful memory is not going to be as awful in the future. And we've used the same concept for developing medicinals. Namely, we're looking for molecules that facilitate these happy chirps. And we've succeeded using powerful modern technologies. So when I retired from Bowling Green, an old colleague invited me to join their drug development group in Northwestern. So Joe Moskal and his group at Falk Center for Molecular Therapeutics said, Jock, why don't you start an affective medicinal development program? And we focused on finding new antidepressants by how they facilitated happy chirping sounds in rats. And we tracked down molecules using genetic approaches, microarrays, and you know, other siRNA silencing certain genes. And lo and behold, we identified molecules that can increase chirping. And one of these has now actually gone through all the preclinical toxicology, and it recently went through stage two human testing, approved by the Food and Drug Administration. So, and it looks like it's really a fine antidepressant that works rapidly, and you know, it seemed to have a week-long therapeutic effect. So Well, the bottom line for us is that we have to take the animal emotions seriously as excellent models for our own human emotions, not only behaviors and learning and memory, but also the actual feeling components. We can finally understand that level of complexity, but we have to shed at least a century of thinking in other ways, and that's a hard job.
Well, that is a great wrap-up, a great place for us to close off here, although it would be easy to keep going on. So, Dr. Jaak Panksepp, thanks for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thanks, Dave.
Well, I hope you are stimulated by this conversation with Dr. Jaak Panksepp as I was. My own subcortical seeking and play centers were lighting up, I'm pretty sure, and I hope yours were too. I was intrigued to learn that he started out as a psychotherapist and then took such a long and significant journey into neuroscience and evolutionary science, and now is in the process of bringing it all back home to clinical work with human beings. I think his book will become a classic and will stand out as a significant turning point for our profession. As you heard, he's not without his critics and hurdles still to overcome. For myself, though, I'm very persuaded by his argument that evolution has provided us with a basic toolkit, and that these subcortical emotional centers drive and provide the tools for survival. I find the evidence he cites both from evolutionary development and studies of mammalian brains to be very compelling. His book, The Archaeology of Mind, is both challenging and readable. It is at once technical and accessible to a non-technical audience. As Dr. Dan Siegel suggests in his preface, the non-technical reader should read it like a novel, without worrying about remembering the names of all the brain centers and hormones and chemicals they are awash in. Just keep reading through all that and trust that it will contribute to the big picture that he develops. And a big picture it is, and an engaging one as well, as he ranges through not only animal and human neuroscience, but also through visits with philosophers such as John Hume, Jeremy Bentham, and Wittgenstein, among others. And also enough sharing of his personal story and opinions to keep one engaged, as well as wrestling with big issues such as the acquisition of language and the relationship of it all to the clinical issues therapists confront. I think it's going to be increasingly important for current and future psychotherapists to be versed in the material covered here. And of course, if you do decide to purchase this highly recommended book, I hope you'll do it through the Amazon widget in the right-hand sidebar on our site. In the interest of brevity, I'm just going to say four little words. Big green donate button. Enough said. I deliberately let this interview run longer than usual because I feel Dr. Panksepp's work is that important. I'll try to keep the rest of the show quite brief as well. I know that most of you listen to Shrink Wrap Radio through some sort of mobile device, but don't forget to explore our site for all the wonderful offers you'll find there, such as links to our CE courses, transcripts, partner offers, book purchase links, and more.
Hi, this is Bruce Ecker, psychotherapist and lead author of Unlocking the Emotional Brain, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Yes, Bruce Ecker will be my next guest. More about that in a moment. First, I'll take the liberty to read just one short email from our listener community. Emma writes from her iPad the following. Hi, Dr. Dave. Being a psychology student, I find your podcasts interesting and informative. I have a strong interest in Jungian analysis and wanted to know whether it would be possible to do some sort of training via distance education in this area as I live in Tasmania, Australia. Any help would be greatly appreciated. Kind regards, Emma. Well, thanks for that, Emma. I have two suggestions. The first, of course, is to take my Jungian continuing education courses that are offered through the Zur Institute on our site. Even if you don't need CE units yet for licensing, you'll learn a lot of Jungian psychology in the process, and you'll earn a certificate of completion, which I think would impress a graduate admissions committee. Beyond that, I'd recommend that you and any other listeners with similar concerns look into the Pacifica Graduate Institute in Santa Barbara, California. I believe they are offering some academically accredited Jungian coursework online. So with that, I think we better wrap it up here once again. And I'll skip over all the contact info in the interest of time. Let me just say thank you to Dr. Jaak Panksepp for taking time out of his very busy schedule to share his groundbreaking work on the neuroevolutionary origins of human emotions. And my next guest, Bruce Ecker, will be a perfect follow-on to today's interview. His book, Unlocking the Emotional Brain, builds directly on Panksepp's by providing a concrete therapeutic application that takes advantage of the brain's capacity to erase painful memories. I'm betting his book will mark a sea change in our understanding of what makes good psychotherapy work. Until next time, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know. And just enough to make you dangerous.